Book of Moses, Textual Criticism 3. Was the Book of Moses simply an unplanned afterthought to Moses 1? A response to Thomas A. Waymond, Intertextuality and the Purpose of Joseph Smith's New Translation of the Bible. In Foundational Texts of Mormonism, Examining Major Early Sources. Edited by Mark Ashurst McGee, Robin Scott Jensen, and Sherilyn Howcroft, 74-100. New York City, New York, Oxford University Press, 2018. In Thomas Waymond's chapter discussing how Joseph Smith initiated a new and ambitious project to translate the Bible, he motivates his analysis by asserting that, quote, the reasons he began the undertaking have never been fully understood, end of quote. He concludes that the impetus for Joseph Smith's translation of the Bible, or JST, came, in essence, as an unplanned afterthought to his having received a revelation of the visions of Moses, Moses 1, which it is argued came in response to questions about Moses and the creation that had arisen over the course of the preceding year. I have great respect for Waymond's well-attested scholarship, and I would not want to minimize the great service he has rendered to Latter-day Saints in his edition of the JST and his New Testament writings, among others. But in this chapter, he is not at his best. While the underlying arguments are not completely without merit, they are at times overstated, and some of the counter-evidence is ignored. In this brief essay, we give a four-part response to the lines of reasoning presented in the chapter. Although it discusses Joseph Smith's translation of the Bible more broadly, the present remarks will be confined to its explanation of the early origins of the JST and the portions of the JST that eventually became known as the Book of Moses. 1. Omission of the prehistory of the Joseph Smith translation. Although it is true there is currently no direct evidence that Joseph Smith was expressly commanded by the Lord to begin a translation of the Bible, as Waymond rightfully observed, multiple lines of evidence suggest that the restoration of lost truths from the Bible have been previously anticipated and possibly even specifically planned for in advance by Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery. Regrettably, none of these elements of the well-known prehistory of the JST is mentioned in the chapter. 2. Questionable claims. Section 2 provides a short discussion on some questionable claims about concurrence with the Joseph Smith Papers Project that are first mentioned early on in the chapter. 3. Was the OT1 Moses 1 manuscript an original dictation or a copy? To further flesh out his thesis, Waymond asserts that the earliest extant manuscript of Moses 1 was a copy, not an original dictation. In Section 3, we show that the received view that Moses 1 is an original dictation of the revelation is a better fit for the evidence. 3. How does all this relate to the bigger picture? Section 4 concludes this essay. The chapter's argument that OT1 Moses 1 manuscript is a copy is part of a larger effort to show that the, quote, Bible revision was its infancy, a kind of editing project to bring existing canonical texts into harmony, end of quote, with the revelations Joseph Smith had received prior to June 1830. I will briefly describe the primary weakness of this argument. Notwithstanding some areas of disagreement with Waymond, I believe he is correct in concluding that Joseph Smith viewed ancient and modern scripture as, quote, consistent manifestations of the eternal and divine gospel of Jesus Christ, end of quote. The Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants are joint witnesses that the restoration of lost truths of the Bible, rather than being an unplanned afterthought, is the realization of prophecies given thousands of years ago. 1. The prehistory of the Joseph Smith translation. Had Waymond included a more complete account of the prehistory of the JST, readers would more easily realize that the impetus for the Bible revision was not the kind of sudden, unexpected development presumed in his chapter. Neglected elements of this prehistory are summarized briefly below. Joseph Smith became aware of the limitations of the Bible as a boy, even before his first vision. In the Prophet's 1838 description of the War of Words, provoked by the religious excitements that preceded that vision, he recounts the futility of, quote, settling the question as to which was the true church by an appeal to the Bible, end of quote, because, quote, the different sects understood the same passages of Scripture so differently, end of quote. He had also noticed that during the visit of Moroni a few years later, the ancient prophet cited the Bible, quote, with a little variation from the way it reads in our Bibles, end of quote. Later, during the translation of the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith would have noticed passages that spoke of plain and precious things that had been removed from the Bible, and of the coming forth of, quote, other books, end of quote, in the last days that would, quote, make known the plain and precious things which have been taken away, end of the quote. In events that presaged the involvement of Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery in restoring lost stories and teachings from the Bible, they had already produced what can be seen as a, quote, new translation of portions of John 21 in April 1829, later published as Doctrine and Covenants, Section 7. In light of these and other preparatory experiences that revealed the current status of the Bible and the future restoration of truths no longer contained within it, it would have been no surprise to Joseph Smith when the Lord revealed in Moses 1 that the visions of Moses it related formed part of these lost works and words, and that he had been raised up to write them so they would be, quote, had again among the children of men, end of quote. Throughout the remainder of his life, the prophet would continue to comment on the significance of these lost texts and truths that were to be revealed, restored, or retranslated. Significantly, there is some support for the idea that Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery made specific preparations for the work of Bible translation in the year prior to its undertaking. For example, in October 1829, they purchased a Bible that was eventually used in the preparation of the JST. Though there is currently no independent evidence that this copy of the Bible was acquired with a new translation in mind, the time frame of the purchase is suggestive. The pioneering JST scholar Robert J. Matthews did not see this idea as unreasonable. He wrote, quote, Oliver Cowdery and Joseph Smith did not state their purpose in purchasing the Bible at that time, but in view of the instructions and experiences they had received, it is possible that they were thinking of a new translation of the Bible, even at that early date. If we assume for a moment that the Bible was purchased in October 1829 in anticipation of a new work of translation, how can the months of delay before it started be explained? Simply put, it was not until June 1830 that Joseph Smith was able to free himself to begin the new work of translation that was intended to restore, quote, many important points touching the salvation of man that had been taken from the Bible or lost before it was compiled, end of quote. The delay is understandable in light of major events that had recently transpired. The Book of Moses, Book of Mormon, had come from the press in March 1830. The church had been organized in April, and the first conference had been held in early June. Moreover, later in June, the same month that Moses 1 was given, tremendous opposition had begun to mount during the visit of the prophet to the saints in Colesville, New York. None of the anticipatory events just described are mentioned by Wayman. Given the relevance of this material to the central arguments of the chapter, the omission of a more inclusive prehistory of the JST is both surprising and regrettable. 2. Questionable claims about concurrence with the Joseph Smith Papers Project. At the outset, the chapter advances some questionable claims about concurrence from the Joseph Smith Papers Project, or JSP, for the views it presents. For example, Wayman supports his argument that the work of Bible translation, quote, was a natural consequence of Joseph Smith's having received Moses 1 in the late spring or early summer of 1830 by a footnote to the sentence where the dating of Moses 1 and its role in motivating the JST is asserted. The footnote states, this is the position taken in the relevant volume of the JSP project. However, by way of contrast to the chapter's assertion, the editors of the JSP volume do not draw the conclusion that the prophet's initial engagement in the work of Bible translation was a, quote, natural consequence of his having received Moses 1. Instead, they provide only the cautious statement that, quote, it is unknown whether J.S. or Oliver Cowdery originally saw this revelation as the initial step of the larger project, end of quote. Moreover, Wayman's assertion that Moses 1 was received, quote, in the late spring or early summer of 1830, end of quote, is equally unsupported by the JSP editors when, in the JSP volume cited, they do not mention the possibility of a late spring date, but instead matter-of-factly refer to the manuscript as the June 1830 revelation, a description that agrees with the dated superscription on the earliest extant manuscript. Of course, it will almost certainly never be possible to conclusively rule out the possibility that Moses 1 was received in the late spring, or whether there was an earlier copy, any more than one can assert today with confidence exactly how much Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery knew in advance about the forthcoming Bible translation project. But we can say with assurance that the cited Joseph Smith Papers volume does not provide the corroborating evidence evidently hoped for, whether for the possibility of a spring dating for Moses 1 or for unwavering support of its conjectured role as the primary spur that motivated the JST project. 3. Was the OT1 Moses 1 manuscript a copy or an original dictation. Arguments that Moses 1 was an original dictation. When one begins to encounter the meat of the chapter's arguments, it becomes clear how much of an uphill climb must be undertaken to support the thesis that Moses 1 was not initially conceived as part of the Bible revision. Below, I will argue briefly that the earliest extant manuscript of the Revelation was deliberately preserved as an integral part of the JST-OT1 manuscript from three lines of evidence. 1. Physical relationship. 2. Scribal continuity. And 3. Literary continuity. 1. Physical relationship. Moses 1 was recorded on the first three pages of a 52-page gathering. Although it is impossible to know for certain when these pages were stitched together, it seems very unlikely that Joseph Smith would have begun to put together a folded booklet of this nature if he only anticipated a single revelation of a few pages. Otherwise, why not just begin writing on a single half sheet? When the text of Moses 1 finishes on page 3, after an inch and a half break containing a heading, the text of the translation of the first chapters of Genesis begins. In short, the positioning of Moses 1 within the OT1 manuscript and in later JST manuscripts suggests that Moses 1 may have been conceived as an integral part of the translation project from its inception. 2. Scribal continuity. Consistent with the idea is the evidence of scribal continuity in the transition between what we take to be the spontaneously revealed Moses 1 and the Bible-prompted revelation of Moses 2. By way of background, Kent Jackson describes the way in which other parts of the OT1 manuscript seem to reflect the transparent ease with which the prophet and his scribes alternated between existing Bible text and new editions dictated by Joseph Smith. He writes that beginning with Genesis 1, quote, "It seems evident that Joseph Smith had a Bible in front of him during the translation and that he read from it while his scribes wrote. When he came to a passage needing revision, he would dictate words not found in the printed text until he came back to the text and continued with it." The writing on the manuscript shows no indication of when the text was coming out of the printed Bible and when it was not. The end of the Moses 1 chapter in the OT1 manuscript, shown above, but regrettably not reproduced like the other two manuscripts pages in Weymouth's chapter, reflects the same general uniformity in writing style described by Jackson. From the major features of the writing style alone, a reader would not suspect that there were significant differences in the revelatory processes that distinguished Moses 1 from Moses 2. In other words, though the prophet's dictation of Moses 2 was a mix of existing Bible verses and his own additions, and by way of contrast, he apparently had no written source for Moses 1, the lack of important differences in the two relevant parts of the manuscript suggests that Moses 1, like Moses 2, was an original dictation, not a copy. Though it might seem an incredible feat for the manuscript of Moses 1 to have been given, seemingly, quote, "without the slightest contemplation, hesitation, or uncertainty," end of quote, it should be remembered that it was not an uncommon thing for Joseph Smith to produce new revelations by means of long, spontaneously spoken dictations. 3. Literary continuity. In addition to evidence relating to the physical relationship and scribal continuity that links Moses 1 to the rest of the JST, there are signs of a literary continuity between the visions related in Moses 1 and the story of creation in Moses 2. Jackson notes that in the transition between the two chapters, the words of Moses 2, quote, "do not give the impression of having been written to stand at the head of a new document, but to continue the texts that precede them," end of quote. Indeed, in further support for this idea, Mark J. Johnson adduces evidence of a chiasm that spans Moses 1:40 through 2:1, thus suggesting the idea that the end of Moses 1 and the beginning of Moses 2 form a coherent literary unit. Counterarguments that seeking to establish that Moses 1 was a copy. To counter the generally received view of an incipient integral connection between Moses 1 and 2, Weymouth seeks to establish that Moses 1 was received as a separate revelation on purportedly lost original manuscript. Eventually, according to this theory, a copy was made and, quote, "later joined to the JST documents as a type of introduction," end of quote. An emphasis on, quote, "joining Moses 1 to the JST documents," end of quote, is highlighted by the repetition of the idea. A little later on, we read similarly, quote, "In this case, Joseph Smith and his scribes sought to join the revelation of 1, Moses 1, with their revision of the Bible," end of quote. Further on it says, quote, "seeing Moses 1 as a document that was, quote, Added to the Bible Revision Project provides an important piece of evidence in understanding the origins and initial interests of the JST." End of quote. Because the intended meaning of these statements is somewhat unclear, the repeated use of the terms "join" and "added to" may lead some readers to mistakenly conclude that after the Bible revision was already begun and some of the, quote, JST documents, end of quote, already existed, the Moses 1 text was added to it. But this is impossible because Moses 1 was received before any of the Genesis chapters were translated. This is witnessed by the fact described above, namely that it appears on the first three pages of the OT1 page gathering, prior to the original dictation of the translation of Genesis 1. In favor of the idea that Moses 1 was a copy of an independent revelation that was later joined to the Bible revision, rather than an original, the chapter identifies several characteristics of its earliest extant manuscript version. According to Wayman, the OT1 manuscript of Moses 1 features a relatively smooth rather than a ragged right edge. While the author cites this feature as often indicating a copy rather than a dictated manuscript, he rightfully qualifies this evidence by an admission that, quote, if the dictation is slow enough, then a scribe can reasonably compensate in some instances, end of quote. As further evidence that full-length lines are not a reliable indicator that the OT1 manuscript to Moses 1 is a copy, a footnote documents the fact that, quote, the Book of Mormon manuscripts, which were also dictated, Cowdery does frequently use the full length of lines, end of quote. Significantly, full-length lines are also apparent for the dictated text of the first verses of JST Genesis on page 3 of the OT1 manuscript. Thus, a generally useful argument cannot be applied to the OT1 manuscript of Moses 1 with any confidence. Inline rather than overline corrections. While inline corrections sometimes provide a good general heuristic for distinguishing copied texts from original dictations, only one instance of an inline correction is supplied by Wayman. All the rest of the corrections mentioned are overline. In other words, of all the corrections cited, only one unequivocally favors the idea of a copy rather than a dictated text. Skipping between similar words. Though the chapter provides one example where such skipping might have occurred, a second example points to a dictation error instead. Thus, the argument is equivocal. Minor errors and corrections. Though Wayman concludes that the examples of minor errors and corrections cited in the chapter suggest a copied document, end of quote, alternative explanations seem equally or more probable for at least some of these. For example, Colby Townsend specifically disputes Wayman's idea that, quote, Cowdery mistakenly saw them on the original manuscript, wrote the word on OT1, and then realized it was wrong and crossed it out and penned the correct "the" next to it on the same line. The problem is that the manuscript clearly reads "the," not "them," end of quote from Townsend. Indicators of pauses in production. Evidence of pauses in the translation are strong indicators of copying only when the pause occurs in unexpected places. The only pause that may fit this criterion in the OT1 Moses 1 manuscript is a stray dot of what is admitted to be uncertain interpretation that occurs one word before the end of a sentence. Of course, stray dots are not uncommon in manuscripts written with a dip pen. Counterexamples. Commendably, Wayman includes two additional examples that run counter to his argument for a copied text. These examples indicate an original dictation. It will be seen that none of the points above advances a convincing argument. However, as we continue to read, this inconclusive evidence is eventually elevated to near certainty. Specifically, though the author begins carefully by admitting at the outset that the evidence is, quote, not overwhelmingly conclusive, or simply stated, inconclusive, that the OT1 version of Moses 1 is a later copy rather than an original, by the time we reach the end of the chapter, the hypothesis that, quote, the original document was eventually copied into OT1 is asserted without any qualification. This confident assertion should be contrasted to the cautious statement of the JSP editors, who simply aver, after a brief acknowledgement of the possibility, that, quote, the evidence is inconclusive, end of quote. Townsend's analysis of the examples provided is less tentative. He states more strongly that, quote, it is difficult to accept the idea that Moses 1 was originally dictated on a separate manuscript page from OT1, end of quote. In other words, contra Wayman, Townsend sees it as more likely that the OT1 Moses 1 manuscript is an original dictation than a copy. 4. How does all this relate to the bigger picture? Weymouth's argument that OT1 Moses 1 manuscript is a copy is part of a larger effort to show that, quote, the Bible revision was, in its infancy, a kind of editing project to bring existing canonical texts into harmony, quote, end of quote, with the revelations Joseph Smith had received prior to June 1830. At first glance, however, the evidence for the connections between the revelations cited and the earlier chapters of the Book of Moses appear to be somewhat loose. Going further, a bigger problem with this reasoning is that the opposite of what is argued is true. The translation of the early chapters of Genesis that eventually became part of the Book of Moses are not simply replications or implications of prior revelations, but rather introduced doctrines that were radical innovations, and in some cases clear departures from many things the prophet seems to have understood prior to that time. As Avram Shannon, citing the extensive work of Robert J. Matthews, puts it, many distinctive Latter-day Saint beliefs are actually first found in the book in the JST. The remainder of the chapter focuses on Joseph Smith's interests, purpose, and intent in producing the Book of Moses, in which it is said that he and his scribes were revising the Bible according to their early theological interests, end of quote. The principal weight of the argument seems to be thrown behind the thesis that Joseph Smith either, quote, purposefully, meaning consciously, revised Genesis to make it, quote, a Christian salvation epic, end of quote, or he did so accidentally because he was, quote, a 19th century Christian himself, end of quote, and essentially was so wrapped up in his own culture that he did not realize what he was doing. Surprisingly, the emphasis of the discussion is almost wholly on human initiative and the conscious or unconscious appropriation of biblical material as the basis for the JST revisions. Inexplicably, the author fails to mention evidence adduced by other scholars that many of the surprising and extensive doctrines, teachings, and narratives contained in the Book of Moses that have little or no biblical basis are arguably related to ancient texts from outside the Bible. Though, of course, the chapter is a scholarly publication, not a devotional treatise, credible studies providing evidence for both literary sophistication and ancient threads in the Book of Moses can and should be considered alongside competent scholarship documenting 19th century influences. The present essay emphasizes several differences with Thomas Weymouth about the origins of the JST. However, none of these differences are ultimately as crucial to faith as an agreement with him regarding the essential element of divine involvement in the revelations and translations of Joseph Smith. It is important to recognize Weymouth's well-attested scholarship and to gratefully acknowledge, as he does in the chapter, that despite the general tendency to see the JST wholly as a result, quote, as a result of Smith's own New Testament worldview, end of quote, there is room to see the translation as, quote, a process of inspiration, end of quote. The spirit of this statement from Weymouth's conclusion deserves applause. Quote, Joseph Smith seems to have viewed all revelation, prophetic writing, and scripture, both ancient and modern, as consistent manifestations of the eternal and divine gospel of Jesus Christ. End of quote from Weymouth. Indeed, Joseph Smith's inspired teachings, translations, and revelations affirm that Adam, Eve, Noah, Abraham, and Moses were actually Christians, the most important and central lost truth that has been restored and prominently featured in every work of Latter-day Saint scripture. And they also affirm, as outlined in the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants, that the JST was not merely an unplanned afterthought to Moses 1, but rather the realization of prophecies given thousands of years ago. To accept Joseph Smith as the prophet of the Restoration is to possess an assurance that this restored truth has a basis in material history.